you ever see a world where material handling is like 100% automated?
Man, you know what? No. I
There you go.
actually don't.
Hello and welcome to Supply Chain Stories. I'm your host, Nathan Cunningham. My co-host today is Alicia Yang. She's also our editor. Our guest today is Michael Schulte, who, despite being young in his career, has an incredible amount of experience. He's worked in procurement roles and supply chain roles. He's also worked for name brand companies such as Tesla, Boeing, and Vivint. He currently works as a logistic engineer for World Class Integrations, a material handling integrations company. Let's dig in. This episode is brought to you by Lutello. Lutello offers no-risk procurement consulting. If they don't save you money, you don't owe them money. 1 hour of your time could save you 10% or more on all your industrial supplies. Check out www.lutello.com to learn more and register.
You are very, very broad experience. Would love to hear, just to give us an intro of your specialties, what you've enjoyed, perhaps. So,
yeah, for sure. So, while growing up, my family actually moved around a little bit for my dad's work. He worked in the automotive industry, still does, for a company called Aptiv, which is formerly known as Delphi. They provide safety and electronics equipment for automakers around the world. And that brought us to, a couple different places growing up. And so I've just always had this intrigue with travel and meeting new cultures. And so when I was introduced to supply chain around 2010, that's when I started to think, oh man, this sounds like an actual global job, right? Like something that provides an opportunity to meet other people, especially in the supplier management realm of supply chain management, right? And so that's something that, which kind of caught my interest. But so I work currently for a material handling and warehousing group. It's kind of a mix between a consulting group and a material handling vendor. I guess a good word for it would be a material handling integrator. So we're an integrator service group. So that's where I currently am.
It's awesome. I want to ask you a question. You've lived in the US, China, and India. We've interviewed quite a few people who have experience sourcing in China, but nobody in India. My question to you to kick us off is, tell us some experiences that highlight, the differences in working in the US, China, and India. Tell us some cultural differences or just some like legal differences. It's like, hey, I can't do this thing in India, but I can do this thing in the US, right? Like, or whatever, in the procurement supply chain world. Tell us a little bit about some of the differences. We'd love to hear about that.
Right. Okay. I think something that stands out to me the most is just China and India, they're just so different from each other. I think the one thing that they have in common is that they're both big countries, right?
Yeah.
But aside from that, take it for what it's worth for me, the two countries are just very different as far as culture goes, as far as infrastructure goes. And I think my knowledge is limited to the north. The south in India may be different. I know it's very, techie down in the south. There's a lot going on down there. Up in the north, there seems to be more manufacturing up in the north. Now, China has done really an incredible job of establishing the infrastructure needed to support the world's manufacturing, right? Like it's pretty obvious. Like China is the world's manufacturer. Whereas, and there's, you know, there's all sorts of great resources to help individuals and companies all over the world find opportunities to create products, to source products from there, right? Just one off the bat, Alibaba. I think everybody at some point has either heard of or taken a look at Alibaba. Yeah. In fact, a couple months ago, before COVID-19 hit the States, I ordered a bunch of carts for a small company here, and they came from Guangzhou in China. And I found them through Alibaba. It was a really simple process. It took a couple days to negotiate everything out, and it turned out great. Good product. Yeah. A great way to measure quality.
Is there an Alibaba India equivalent in India?
Not that I know of. Okay. Not that I know of. There might be, and if there is, I'd love to know about it.
Yeah. If anybody's listening.
So that's
great.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's an idea for you. That's something I've actually thought about, where, man, if South America had something like that, or Africa or India, obviously it takes good infrastructure as well too. And a good way to measure quality. But yeah, Alibaba just really hit onto something well with that. With India, so that's one of the points I wanted to bring up with India. It's relatively harder to access information for manufacturing in India. On my level, right? Just consumer level, like, hey, I want to make a product. It's a little bit harder for me to dig up information to find for suppliers over there.
There's companies out there.
Second,
we know they're out there. We just don't know who they are, how to contact them, what they sell exactly, right? Yeah.
Right. If probably the best route to go would be through some kind of agency who's built up a network of their own, right? Mm. It's not necessarily democratized. So, I think the infrastructure is a little bit different as well too. They're pouring a lot of resources into building things up. Even in my time in India, there were a couple instances where an address would be like the 11th, pillar of the rail station, and to your right, like that was the address for this place I was looking for. It wasn't necessarily like handwritten instructions. It was literally like, this is the 11th pillar and to the right of it. Right. So, I loved my time in India. It was just so different from anything I'd ever experienced before. I love it so much. I would look for any opportunity to go back, to visit, to work. It's just a really cool place. And in a way, I think they are kind of experiencing what China was going through like a decade ago or 20 years ago, right? Where they're, but also they're a little bit different because they're, most countries go through these phases where they kind of go through a manufacturing spurt first and then get into high tech, right? Whereas with India, they kind of went into high tech first. And exactly. They get into manufacturing, kind of uplifts the entire country. And then they start, getting into different ways of making money. And for a lot of the world, that's been getting into more high tech related fields. Whereas in India, they kind of jump straight into the high tech stuff right away. And their manufacturing sector hasn't the same, they haven't seen the same level of globalization as other countries have, as they were, maturing in their, I don't know what I'm what word I'm looking for, yeah. but I hope you're getting the point.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it'll be interesting in 10 years, because you said India's kind of going through the same thing as China did 10 years ago. It'll be interesting to see in 10 years if India has surpassed anybody as far as being the high-tech country, right? Like, if they're like, yeah, now we're the high-tech country, even if our manufacturing isn't phenomenal, it's good, right? But our high-tech sector is the best in the world, right? Like, you know, who knows what's going to happen. But it'll be interesting to see that contrast, or if it's like a bad strategy. It's like, maybe they fail. Maybe they're like, yeah, we can't get into high tech until our manufacturing is better. So it's like, you know, they go along this high tech path and then it doesn't work. And so then they switch and they're like, okay, shoot, we got to go back and get our manufacturing back to where it needs to be. That'd be interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a really good point. And
who knows, right?
I just want to emphasize once again, like, I'm not saying that. Yeah. Yeah. In this high-tech talent pool is incredible, right? Like, just look at the leaders of some of the biggest companies over here. You know, Satya at Microsoft, right? Like, there's just really impressive talent, and some of the brightest people I've ever met are from India. So they're, you know, really bright. Talent pool. So it'll be really cool to see what's happening with manufacturing.
That's great. Thanks for sharing that story. So switching topics a little bit, your current company is an integrator of material handling. I'd love to hear kind of what you offer for companies out there that do manufacturing, I guess, is one, and then warehousing, right? So it's like, if I'm just a warehouse, what could you offer? Like, what specialties? And then if I'm a manufacturer, what kind of specialties do you have there? And how does your supply chain experience feed into your company?
So I think the first thing that would be good to mention is that the material handling industry is an entire industry in and of itself. But it acts as a support function to supply chain management, right? Supply chain management is what establishes the processes, designs the operations, and makes it happen on a strategic level and with the personnel. But the personnel and those processes need equipment to make it happen as well too, right? So that's where material handling comes in. That's I'll touch on warehousing first, since that is really our primary focus. We do some work with manufacturing, but it seems to be more so with warehousing, especially with all the e-commerce activity that's going on right now. Warehousing and distribution are just super hot. So material handling within a warehousing context, this is your storage equipment, your conveyor equipment. So when you're moving stuff internally inside a warehouse, this is your stuff to sort stuff. Like when you have several packages that need to get out to different trucks, sorting equipment is what the computers will, ping in order to tell them, send this package to this truck and this one to this truck and this one to that truck. So that's material handling equipment. It's exactly as it sounds. It helps you to handle your product in a way that's safe, ergonomic, good for the product itself, and to get it from point A to point B. So what we provide, we are an integrator. So we work to design and engineer systems that are tailored to a client's specifications, right? Each customer is different in some way. And so we help them to figure out how to take equipment and apply it specifically to their operation in order to get the most bang for their buck.
So everything's tailored to like a specific need. And there's a lot of e-commerce trends. We've talked to a few people here about automation. I'm curious how you determine to automate versus not. Like, There's obviously a growing trend in supply chain to automate everything, right? Like, and so how do you make that determination within material handling of things?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting question because, you know, automation gets a lot of hype, but it's not always the answer. With what we're looking for, oftentimes a client will come to us and say, hey, we're interested in putting in this type of solution, and it'll end up being a nice shiny silver bullet, right? But you know, we try and go in and we say, hey, let's actually take a step back, look at what you're doing, and then make sure that actually makes sense. And the reason for that is if you have a bad process, you don't want to automate the bad process, because you would just be like, that's what you're doing. Automation doesn't solve a problem. It automates, it automates whatever you're doing to solve that problem. And so you want to refine the actual process first as best as possible. Make sure that it's clean, it's smooth. And then once it's to a point where it's so repeatable that it doesn't necessarily need a human anymore, then you can involve the automation, and that's where you see the best results. And I think, you know, just from you being in the industry as well, that's probably something you've come across as well too, is, you know, people are oftentimes looking for a solution to their problem and just assume, oh, this is getting a lot of hype. It's a, you know, it's getting a lot of press, but it's not actually the right solution to your problem.
Yeah, you assume, you know, you have a problem and you assume, well, if I automate this, my problem goes away.
Right.
That's not true.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So that's one of our biggest, as a company, that's one of our biggest things, is let's make sure your process is good, and then look into automation. I would like to add one more thing, is that sometimes automation doesn't make sense because automation oftentimes is not super flexible. Once you have it, you're locked into it. And so if your company is, you know, if there's a ton of seasonality, or I'm trying to think, or for example, like this doesn't happen all the time, but the black swan events, right? Like COVID-19,
right?
you're locked into a solution that you have, and it's not super agile in the sense that you can't just throw bodies at it and change it up, right? You're kind of locked into the speed of your conveyor. It can only go so fast, or you know what I'm saying? You can't necessarily upscale or downscale as quickly.
Yeah, you have to have the repeatability and confident in your repeatability, or automate flexibility, right? Like flexible automation, you know.
Exactly. You need to preserve some sense of flexibility in what you're doing.
Yeah, it's interesting.
So, Michael, do you, since like we mentioned like flexibility and everything about it, do you ever see a world where material handling is like 100% automated, like after some like flexibility or with something we can control? Like, do you ever see a 100% automated material handling?
Man, you know what? No.
I actually don't.
I think the goal everyone is aiming for is the lights out operation, right? You can just shut off the lights, walk out of the room, and let the thing run on its own. That's a pretty common buzzword you'll hear if you're looking at magazines like DC Velocity, or, you know, even sometimes on 24/7 Supply Chain, or every once in a while you'll see that term, the lights out distribution center. Have you guys ever had a chance to tour an Amazon facility?
I haven't.
Okay.
But I've been in a warehouse that I've been in some facilities like, I don't know about Amazon level, but that are distribution companies, right? That mm-hmm. are pretty highly automated.
Okay. Okay. So I just use Amazon as an example. Like, I think that's a company that, you know, is trying to be on the forefront of distribution and, you know, what technologies and processes and that they're using, but they're packed with people. And, you know, while they're throughout time, we may see that people will be less and less involved. I think there will always, to some degree, you know, be a need for people in the operation. I can't foresee the future, but I just, sometimes I kind of look at, do you remember Elon's, the machine that builds the machine?
Right. Yeah. They talked about that a lot.
Yeah. And he just wanted to automate the whole thing. But there kind of came a point where he realized that, you know, the manufacturing needs people. Like there are just some things that just need people to do it. And, so, you know what,
Elon acknowledged that he said that they automated too much, you know, and
yeah,
that people are underrated. I think that's a quote. Yeah.
Such an Elon thing to say.
yeah. But it is true. And I agree. I think there's going to be situations and certain processes that could be lights out, but you won't. I probably agree with you that there will never be an end-to-end 100% automated material handling, because it's just it's probably not feasible. But right. But you know, there could be certain components, right? An order comes in and a robot grabs it off the shelf and puts it into like a WIP or a work in progress, you know, phase. And then once it's in the WIP center, then you know, whatever happens, right? Like, you know, then you switch to manual, and then so lights out, you could build up your WIP lights out, so to speak, right? But yeah, I probably agree that it's never going to be 100%,
right?
Because even the robots need maintenance, so
yeah, that's true too. So I like what you're saying there. A lot of components definitely will, and they are becoming automated. Especially those tasks that are just, it's so clearly reproducible, repeatable, and simple. You know, it makes sense. Why not throw some automation in there? Especially with, you know, I'm all about job creation. So don't let me be the one over here saying, nah, like kill the jobs. But before the coronavirus, there was a job shortage. It's, you know, it was really hard to come by, people who were willing to work, in these distribution centers. And so that was another reason why customers would come to us, is because it's, hey, we are having a hard time finding talent. So is there anything we can do in the meantime to alleviate this? Right.
Yeah.
So I think that's another perspective to consider, is sometimes there are just not enough people who are able to do it.
Supply chain will never be 100% automated, but I think that there's leaps and bounds that can be done in productivity in our supply chains, right?
Right.
Where, you know, dollars per employee, revenue per employee, I think is a great metric for supply chain productivity. If you're in warehousing and manufacturing, you know, to see how you can automate more. Mm-hmm. But again, it's never going to be one employee, and you're never going to have one employee that has 100% of the revenue for the company, right?
Right.
And
so
there's always going to be people that are working, and if you're hitting your peak of, like, you can't hire more, then yeah, you gotta find a way to automate some of the things that they're doing so that they can do more value added things, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. That's a great point.
So diving a little bit deeper into the material handling supply chain, mm-hmm. share anything confidential, but share an experience where you saw the most gains, where you said, wow, this is exactly how it should be working. And it works just seamlessly. You're like, we got a project, they gave us the specs, we came in and it was just flawless. Tell us an experience like that.
Yeah. So one that I can think of in particular, we had a small, this was about 8 months ago or so. The completion of the project was about 8 months ago. But we had a small third-party logistics group, so a 3PL, that specializes in e-commerce consumer packaged goods. So, you know, little toys, knickknacks, stuff that you would buy on Amazon or a Shopify store, right? Sure. They have two facilities in the U.S., one here in Utah, one on the East Coast. And they came to us and said, hey, we are experiencing tremendous growth. We are needing to move into a new, so this was kind of a two-phase problem. We are A, needing to move into a new facility, and then B, once we move in, we want to do this right. We want to get it right the first time. And so our first task with them was to decide how much, essentially, you know, what size facility do they need to not only allow them to handle their growth, but we don't want to make it too big, whereas they're locked into something if something were to go wrong. So the first thought, I think outside of what we do, I think to anyone else, they would say, well, let's look purely at the square footage, right? But there's a lot of vertical space that could be used. You know, with storage, you can go up too. You don't just have to go out and expand outwards. And so we came to them and said, well, this is what you currently have. This is what we need from you in order to decide this. So we try to take a very data-driven approach. We look at the SKUs that they have, the activity that those SKUs are experiencing, so the transactions that they have. Mm-hmm. And then back on the SKUs, we try and look at the profile, right? So what are the dimensions of it? What are the weights? And then with this information, essentially a lot of the information that you can get from their warehouse management system, we try to use this to understand better what would be a good tailored solution for their operation. And the nice thing about them is that because this is an area where they try to stay in the consumer packaged goods, we can forecast out a little bit as well too, to say their goods are probably not going to change too much, right? They're probably not going to bring on a customer who does kayaks and canoes as well too. And so that gives us, yeah. Right. Exactly. So this allows us to forecast out a little bit. You know, we never know how many customers are going to bring on. They may bring on 30 versus, you know, 10. But we can figure out, at what rate they bring on or go through a customer. And we can see how much product is coming in and out of the warehouse. So with this information, this helped us decide a few things. This helped us kind of plan out a rudimentary unit load area, which is your pallets that come in from overseas. And this lets us plan out kind of a rough area. Okay, this will go here. And then a forward pick area, which is, this is the area where product that is picked and then put in packages and shipped out. That area is separate from the pallet area.
Distinguishing different areas of their warehouse based off certain functions. Yeah.
Exactly. So you'll have your staging area, your unit load, your forward area. You'll have your pack stations, if they need conveyor, they only needed a little bit of conveyor. So it wasn't too complicated there. But their data informs us of essentially where to lay things out, right? It informed our decision on how it should look. And this allowed us to go back to them and say, hey, we know originally you were looking at this 120,000 square foot facility, but we are very confident and we have the numbers to show for it that you could actually get away with a 70,000 square foot footprint, which real estate, especially distribution and warehousing real estate, is at a premium. Yeah. Yeah. So that proved
50,000. That's almost half.
Yeah. So that comes with some careful management, right? That's you need to find ways to really increase your space utilization and really increase that vertical space as well too. So they locked into that 70,000 square feet and then they were able to lease the rest of their space. So they still went with that facility, but they just partitioned it and rented it out essentially.
Oh, that's great. Which allows them for future growth if needed.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's smart.
Future growth as needed, as well as a potential, revenue stream to help alleviate any costs or so once that was solved, this is where we really started to dig in to designing their facility and build out a 3 to 5 year growth plan, essentially of this is how you're going to expand. This is how you can do it. And this is how much square footage and cube that it will build for you. And so this was something that we wrapped up about 8 months ago. And I think one of the biggest material benefits from it was that e-commerce just saw this massive boom when coronavirus became a deal here. E-commerce just exploded and they were a part of that as well too. So they've been able to manage that, pretty well. And they have their space that they need to expand.
That's great.
And so, yeah, so I think that's just one example I think of when it comes down to what we do can actually have an impact on someone's operation. With the right equipment and the right layout combined with your process that's optimized, you can have a small footprint, but still achieve the same, expectations in, what's the word I'm looking for? Same expectations in growth,
right?
As well as, What am I trying to say?
You leave the flexibility in there from a
exactly
perspective, which is a theme of this show, this episode. It seems like is flexibility, right?
Yeah.
Which is funny because you're a lot of what you're doing is in automation, and the theme is flexibility. So that's great, and that's good to know.
Flexibility and sorry, I just want to jump in. The word I was looking for was productivity. Like you are still able to achieve the same amount of flexibility and productivity, but with a smaller footprint. And it's just and it's because you found a good way to. You have a good holistic approach to your operation, which not only includes the process itself, but the people and the equipment.
So you talked about building up, and since this is an audio podcast, people can't see my hands, but you're building up and you're building out, right? Mm-hmm. Typically when you're trying to optimize a footprint, optimize for growth, do you build out first and then every year as you experience growth, you add one layer up and up? Or do you say, hey, let's say you have three layers up that you can go. Do you go three layers up first? And then once you've maxed out your three layers up, you build the next row out?
It's
really confusing for the audio. So I apologize to everybody. But do you build out or up first? The right question.
Yeah, no, that's a cool question. and I hate to be that guy, but it depends, right? Like that always seems to be the safe answer. I know. but it really does depend. And the reason why is because at the end of the day, you're trying to save money, and money in this situation, in the warehouse, is dependent upon your ability to decrease distance and time, which are actually pretty related. For example, so you have a product, say you sell like sandals, right? Especially in e-commerce, you're typically only buying one pair of sandals. You're not going out and buying like 20 pairs, right? So it's not like brick and mortar.
You're not, but I'm, oh. I'm kidding.
No, that's fair. That's fair. But
most people buy one pair of sandals. You're right.
Right. Right. If you go and look at most data are showing that consumers typically only buy somewhere between one and two products when they go and visit a website. It's an overwhelming majority. So what that means on the operational side is you're sending out one person to travel a long way to go and pick one product and bring them back to a packing area, pack it. Like there's a lot going into sending out that. Yeah. There's a lot going into that one product, right? Now there are ways to alleviate that. You can batch orders together. So all of the similar orders that look like each other, you can send out one person and they can pick all 50 orders that include the same sandal, right? Mm-hmm. However, the point is distance and time are expensive in an e-commerce situation. And so when you're looking at a footprint, you need to decide, am I increasing my distance by expanding out more than building up, or vice versa? And then the other situation is, do I have really enough to justify a full second tier, right? So if you're at a point now where it's like, okay, I have enough product and I have enough, replenishments that I could put on a second tier, then yeah, it would make sense to build this. Or if I feel like I'm on a good trajectory where I'm going to grow into this, let's go ahead and build it and keep my footprint smaller. And that will justify not expanding it. However, in reality, a lot of these picking areas, they're modular. So you could really build up or out. It just really depends on, at the end of the day, what makes the most sense, time and distance wise.
Michael, can I ask you what suggestion will give to either like people or students who are about to go into the supply chain industry? Like what suggestion do you think is the most helpful to them?
I would say the most important thing I think for anyone is to build a network, get to know people. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is this will help you grow a lot. Mm-hmm. This will help you kind of transition textbook knowledge into hearing about the application of that knowledge, right? You get to hear about other people's experiences. Mm-hmm. And this could lead to job opportunities as well too. Okay. I think that's something that I've actually really liked about LinkedIn. That's how I met Nathan, was through LinkedIn, right? So but I think that's a good example of how networking helps. It connects you with people who are in your field, can help you learn, but then as well as can help you find opportunities that that you would excel at. The other side of it is supply chain has a really good strong mix of people skills and as well as technical ability as well too. There's a math component too. So try and find ways to beef up either. You know, if you're feeling like you need to strengthen your soft skills, work on that. But if you feel like you need a little bit of help on the math side as well too, it's worth putting the effort in, because I feel like I use math every single day. Those are two pieces of advice I think I would give.
Thank you. Those are very helpful.
I think that's a perfect explanation of supply chain. It's the balance between soft skills and people skills, and and hardcore math and optimization, right? And it's just managing the balance between those two. So yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and then you sprinkle in a little bit of ambiguity in it.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, it's a man. That, I think that's why I enjoy it so much. Like you said, there it's just a whole mix of a lot of things, and it keeps it very adventurous, and you face new problems every day.